ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is the Religion and Ethics Report, and my name is Avani Dias. I'm filling in today for Andrew West as we celebrate International Women's Day. So I'm the ABC's South Asia correspondent. I'm coming to you live from New Delhi, which is where I live. And it's a really interesting time here in India. We're heading into a national election where the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is trying to get a rare third term. And he's relying on women to get him there. I do want to tell you as well, I've got a new ABC podcast, Looking for Modi, on the ABC Listen app. There is a preview there now. So India is the largest democracy in the world. But there's been a really huge shift in who is going to the ballot box. In the election this year, 49% of voters will be women, and women will outstrip male voters by the 2029 elections. And Modi's made it part of his pitch to appeal to women. He constantly lists all these things he's done for them, like a scheme to save daughters and stop girls being killed in the womb. He's a really smart politician. But are his initiatives actually helping improve the lives of women day to day? And how does he appeal to female voters when his roots are from a far-right organisation which still doesn't allow women into its meetings? And we're here with three amazing Indian women who have different backgrounds. In the city of Mumbai, which is on India's west coast, we've got award-winning journalist Neeja Chowdhury. Her career has spanned 40 years, which is incredible. From the University of Adelaide, we have Priya Charko, and Dr. Charko's research looks at authoritarian and populist governance in India. And in Melbourne, we're joined by former Miss Universe Australia, Maria Thetil. And Maria is a TEDx speaker. She's an actor, an author of the book Unbounded, and I'm a big fan of her on Instagram as well. Thank you, all of you, for joining us.
Gee, that was generous. Thank you.
Right. Well, I do want to start by asking you all what International Women's Day means to you. And it's a big question, right? Because I feel like I've grappled with this for a while. Is it tokenistic? Is it actually empowering women? Maria, first to you, what do you think about the day?
I think for me, it is just such a stark reminder to, yes, celebrate our progress, but how far we have to go. And as someone who is, you know, ethnically Indian, but born and raised in Australia, even though, you know, we're looking at different socio-political contexts, I think there is still so much that needs to change before we can see, you know, changes to, you know, gender inequality. And for me, in my work, what's really important to me is to make sure that I use my own experiences as a woman of colour, as a daughter of immigrants, as a queer woman, to talk about how not all inequality is equal. And when we're looking at, you know, different intersections of our identity, it affects different people, you know, different women differently. So for me, International Women's Day is a very big reminder of how much we have to do to support different communities of women, but that we can do it and to keep using our voices.
Neeja Chowdhury, I'm keen to go to you next because in India, women are such a big vocal force. What is International Women's Day like here?
International Women's Day means to me taking stock of how far we've come and celebrating that and also looking at the journey we still need to cover. Having a day to celebrate it forces political parties, governments in the states, at the national level, all to take note of this. And I remember as a cub reporter, I cut my teeth in journalism by writing a column on women's issues in The Statesman, one of our national dailies. And I remember what a heave-ho it used to be to zero in on women's issues, to get public attention, to fight for space in the media. You were assigned to, you know, covering cookery or flower shows, those kind of events. Today, women are at the top of every profession. Today, we are covering whether it's space, whether it's politics, whether it's science, the nuclear issues. We are covering it all. And it's a huge stride women in India have made.
I can't imagine having to just focus on cooking and things like that and having no option to do anything else. It's crazy that you've seen all that change. Priya Charko, what do you think? Do you think that for Indian women especially, that International Women's Day still has relevance?
I think for women everywhere, International Women's Day has relevance in terms of looking back and appreciating the women that have fought for things like labour rights and the continuing challenges they face and in the workplace and in those sorts of areas, economic inequality, women, you know, are going backwards in all sorts of parts of the world, particularly after the COVID pandemic. So it's an opportunity to celebrate how far we've come. However, this progress is really fragile and it's constantly being eroded. So it's important to be alert to that and to incorporate it in the way that we research and work.
Maria, what do you think, because you are really outspoken about being a queer South Asian woman and you know, coming out in quite a conservative family when it came to your father being a Catholic priest, but they're so open and accepting of you and they're all over your Instagram and stuff like that. I mean, how do you feel as a queer woman on a day like this, thinking about how far women have come, South Asian queer women in particular?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question, because when I think of, even within my own family, how far we've come, like you said, Dad was a Catholic priest, he hails from Kerala, Mum's from Calcutta, and they grew up in a very culturally conservative context. And so when they came here and immigrated to Australia, you know, they had no way of knowing, how do we raise two queer kids? I came out much later in life than my younger brother. And I think the importance of that, when we're talking about that kind of representation for South Asian women, because I am outspoken, as you said, and I do like to share my life and my views unapologetically. But in many parts of the world, that isn't the reality for women. And in particular, if we're talking about this, you know, we have to acknowledge that, you know, for example, transgender women, they experience, you know, violence and discrimination disproportionately just for being. And that's why on days like this, when we talk about why we still need to have IWD, and to echo the points that, you know, Priya and Nidra just made, when we still have work to do, when women are still being killed for what they do with their bodies, choices that they make, you know, reproductively, who they love, then we still need it. And I think when it comes to gender and sexuality, yes, there are still places in the world where women don't get to just be, and their gender and sexual identity is used against them, and they're forced into boxes of heteronormativity. So I love getting to freely advocate for that and show and role model that if a 69-year-old ex-priest can change his views to love and support his kids and to champion a person's right to just be, then there's hope. There absolutely is hope.
That's so amazing. I mean, Nidra, what do you think about it? Like here in India, you know, Maria's talking about her father, how he's been able to change his mindset. Do you feel like society in India is changing out of those sort of traditional mindsets and open to being more accepting of women who are out there and open about either their sexual identity, their jobs, their work, who they are as people? What do you think?
Yeah, I think change is very rapid if you look at the ground level. You look at a state like Haryana in India, in the north of India, which is giving a lot of wrestlers, and women are taking to wrestling and making their mark at a global level. You know, last year there was a huge outcry because certain wrestlers alleged that they had been molested by those in charge of the wrestling foundation. And it became a huge controversy. And I went back to Haryana to these villages which produced these women and trained them. And I found, to my utter astonishment and delight, that the parents and families of all these girls, despite all the so-called risks attendant to the training of these girls in wrestling and working in a male-dominated world, they wanted these girls to go in for wrestling and acquire global recognition. That is a huge change over a period of only 10 years when one has gone to those very areas and covered honor killings. You know, this change that's happening involving women is a very rapid change. And we have today a tribal woman as the president of India, a tokenistic position. But what the message that it is sent out to the tribal women of the country, I too can make it. I traveled at election time and I see, when I talk to younger women, I see stars in their eyes, you know, what they want to achieve. This was not the case, say, even 10, 20 years ago. I sometimes say this not out of rhetoric, but I say, you know, this century is going to belong to women.
That was so well said.
Yeah. It really was. I mean, and that idea of, yeah, seeing stars in their eyes and so much hope. And wrestling is such a masculine sport as well. But I met those wrestlers and they become such a vocal voice in India against sexual assault. They've alleged that a member of Narendra Modi's party, the BJP, has been involved in sexual assault in their wrestling federation. And he denies that. But it's such an interesting point, Priya, because you obviously focus on politics in India. What do you think about Narendra Modi's government? It's a Hindu nationalist government. How do they view women? Do they see them still stuck in those traditional roles, or do they see them, as Nija's just told us so articulately, as people who are moving forward and moving this country forward?
Look, I think it's a bit of both. So, you know, there was a big gender gap in voting for the BJP, even in the 2014 election, but by 2019, that gender gap had closed. And one of the reasons for that is because, as you said, Modi mobilizes women. He appeals to women. He has policies specifically designed targeting women. He talks about giving women dignity, empowering women, things like that. And he's not the only politician that does this, of course. Mamata Banerjee in West Bengal does it as well, does it very well, and has a big support base among women. But at the national level, I think Modi's been the most successful at doing it. The Congress Party has its own women-centered policies. But for various reasons, the BJP has been really successful in mobilising women. However, that doesn't mean that the BJP departs from traditional gender norms. So, for instance, they'll offer microcredit to women to start businesses. But Modi will talk about, you know, microcredit loans as a supplement to women's roles as mothers, as daughters, and so on. So, you know, he'll talk about how women can start sewing businesses, they can start cookery businesses on the side while they take care of the children. So it's a little bit of both. The government certainly wants women as voters, but it also wants them to stay in traditional gender roles because Hindu nationalism is conservative. It's an interesting mix because you can't necessarily control that, right? Women can't be controlled when they're empowered and aspirational. So women we've seen have come out and protested against policies. They've been at the forefront of protests against the citizenship amendment law. But as a result of that, they've also been charged with sedition, with terrorism, and so on. So there's both a mixture of empowerment in the BJP, but also quite a lot of repression. So the chief of the wrestling association, who was, you know, accused of sexual harassment, is still free. He hasn't been brought to account, and Modi has not said anything about him.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Nija, because I've been to a lot of political rallies for Modi, for the BJP, and it's men out there. You barely see any women. You see a lot of orange, the saffron colour of Hinduism. And, you know, he's obviously pushing this idea that India, a secular country, should be a Hindu-dominant place and a Hindu-first place. And that's something that we've seen throughout his political career. So considering he has all this support among women, why aren't they out there sort of chanting for him on the streets? Or what do you think in your experience of what you've seen?
You know, economic hardship should affect women the most. And that is conservative logic. And it does, because they have to make both ends meet for their families. And yet, what you say is true. More women vote for Narendra Modi than possibly do men. Of course, the reasons are the same as would apply to men. He's a powerful, strong leader. He has no family in tow, no son to leave things for. And people in villages will tell you this. And then he emphasizes the Hindu identity. He's gone in for many schemes that give something tangible in the hands of people, and so on. So social welfareism is also a very important part of his way to attract women voters. But I think it is the spiritual, religious, emotional content of his message that has an additional appeal for women voters. And somehow it's true, the BJP has been considered as a more of a traditionalist party than some other parties in the past. But today he is reaching out to women voters in a big way, talking about empowerment of women. And I think somewhere it's resonating. Of course, other leaders are also doing it, as was mentioned earlier. Mamata Banerjee, Nitish Kumar in Bihar, and Priyanka Vadra Gandhi. But certainly Narendra Modi, his message has resonated with women voters.
Yeah, and it's interesting because his message, he's constantly using language like our mothers, sisters, daughters. He has a lot of statements that seem inclusive of women. And as you say, there are quite a few economic policies and religious policies really that appeal to women. But Maria, what do you think about actual changes on the ground? Do you think that Indian women's lives are getting better in the last 10 years under Modi?
Well, I think that it's, you know, a very complicated question. And there are elements where, you know, it looks like things have been improving and then areas where it is a little bit more superficial and therefore you don't see progress. I think for me, understanding this initiative around, for example, you know, encouraging the nurturing and education of women and girls and trying to put value on their lives, I think it's very difficult when you're coming up in a society where women aren't just, you know, devalued at times and negatively valued. And I think when we're looking at this PM who is, in my opinion, and this is just, you know, my opinion, I think it's very clever political gameplay to appeal to women by, you know, cash handouts and cheaper loans and this and that. But as far as tangible efforts to improve the lives of women go, I think so long as you're still trying to do it within, you know, these, like we were just talking about, these muscular ideals of nationalism. We're looking at women having certain roles and not stepping too far out of them. You know, yes, there are great initiatives to improve representation in parliament. And yes, there are these initiatives around saving our daughters. But look at that, for example. There was an audit report that came out and said that most of the funds were disproportionately spent on media and advocacy. And there was a lack of clarity around like specific tasks and duties in certain areas. And so I think the Prime Minister is a very clever politician. And I do believe that whilst some of the initiatives have, you know, led to improvements because, you know, to echo Nija's point, she was talking about the female wrestlers. We know from previous research that representation like that, it does have positive impacts on changing attitudes towards women's leadership and improving aspiration and educational attainment for women and girls and things like that. But overall, I think there needs to be more than surface level and, you know, the visible performative elements of improving things for women and not just seeing women as, hey, these are important decision-making groups. We now need to quickly get their vote to retain power. I think it needs to go deeper than that and be a more meaningful endeavour because there's still a way to go.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report on RN and ABC Listen. You're with me, Avani Dias, the South Asia correspondent and host of the new podcast, Looking for Modi. I'm filling in for Andrew West for International Women's Week. And we're looking at women in India, especially how influential they are in the lead up to a national election here in India later this year. Joined by three amazing Indian women, Maria Thattil, author, former Miss Universe Australia, Nija Chowdhury, journalist and political commentator, and Priya Chacko, associate professor of International Politics at the University of Adelaide. And I want you to think about having the conversation with your partner that you're finally going to take that step to move in together. But imagine that in order to do that, you have to tell the government. I want to talk about this really divisive law that's been introduced in the state of Uttarakhand, which makes you do exactly that. The state is in the Himalayas. It's ruled by Narendra Modi's party. And if you're not married there, you have to register your relationship or face jail time. You have to flag with a government office if you're moving in together and if you break up. And in a country like India, which is just so diverse with people following so many different religions, this is the first state that's put in a civil code that applies to everyone, regardless of their religion or gender. In other states, if you're Hindu, Muslim, Christian, whatever, you follow your own personal rules and customs, or you can abide by India's secular rules. And Muslim people have said the law unfairly targets their community, and there's concerns that this could expand across the country. Priya, can you tell us firstly, why is this such a controversial law?
This brings the state into the bedroom, basically, doesn't it? It's a huge invasion of privacy. It's inconvenient for people. And it's minorities in India that get targeted with these types of laws. If you're rich, if you're Hindu, if you're middle class, you'll probably be fine. But if the police want to target you and you're Muslim and you're a man or a Hindu woman who has married a Muslim man, you'll be targeted. So it's, you know, it's contrary to the right to privacy, which is something that the Supreme Court has said that all Indians have a right to, according to the Constitution. And it's a law that's going to target minorities because we've seen this over and over again in India.
And Nisha, can you explain why this is something that the BJP, Narendra Modi's party, has prioritised as something that they wanted to bring in?
Going for a uniform civil code is part of our what are called the directive principles of state policy, which is enshrined in our constitution, Article 44. And this was brought in 1948. Now, it is something that has not been done over the years because personal laws have governed issues such as marriage, inheritance, divorce, alimony, adoption, and so on. And the one of the core agendas of the BJP has been to bring in a uniform civil code. And now the state of Uttarakhand has gone ahead with doing it. And of course, it gives equal rights in inheritance and so on. But this point that you referred to, that live-in relationships will have to be registered. In other words, it makes the woman in a traditional society vulnerable to vigilantism. People can attack her because it will be, you know, information that then publicly known. So this has come in for criticism. The second part of the story is that the minorities do not want a uniform civil code. They feel it is the intention of the uniform civil code. In, you know, ostensibly it's okay. It gives equal rights. But they suspect that it is actually to target the minorities and to create a Hindu-Muslim polarization in the country, which will go to the advantage of the BJP. This is what they suspect. But as far as Uttarakhand is concerned, what Uttarakhand has also done is it's left the tribal communities out, but included the Muslims. So if it is a uniform civil code, it should apply to all, not leave out the tribals. But because the tribals have reacted to it sharply and the tribals are a vote bank of the BJP, it is believed that the BJP has left them out of the loop of the law. So, I mean, as I say, it is a very controversial law. And other states, BJP-ruled states, also plan to enact it. Assam is one of those states, and Gujarat also. So it is going to be a hot potato in the weeks to come, in the run-up to the elections.
Maria, can you imagine doing this? Like, moving in together is such a big deal in any South Asian household, and, you know, especially when you have to tell your parents something like that. Imagine having to tell the government office. How would it have changed your life if you had to do that?
Oh my goodness, I can't even imagine. I think there are just so many different things. I guess I feel so lucky, you know, to be born and raised into a family and into a context where I can just live freely and express myself freely in that way. But I think so many of these things that we see, I just think it's anti-democratic. And I just think, you know, it's meant to be a secular society. How can you impose conditions like that? And just listening to what, you know, Nija was talking about, like with this code and what they expect, yes, so much of it is a very hot debate. It's very complicated and it's very nuanced. But I think the focus should be on, you know, implementing gender-just practices and getting rid of outdated discriminatory ones, as opposed to imposing conservative and, you know, well, what's ultimately a Hinduized code for living for everybody, because that's not what everybody believes. So no, I can't imagine it. And I think it would be quite regressive if, you know, these sorts of things continue to happen and grow and spread. And I think it just is a slap in the face of everything people in the country have fought to, you know, move forward from.
Mm-hmm. Priya, there are some interesting developments in this, though. For example, it grants equal inheritance rights to sons and daughters. And you know, more broadly, we're seeing Narendra Modi bringing housing schemes where women are the signatories, so they have the house ownership and so on. Do you see elements of this that have positives in the right direction for women?
Yeah, I think all the personal law codes have elements in them that are gender unjust. So if there was reform of that, that would be good. And some of the things that have been done with the UCC in Uttarakhand do further those aims with the inheritance laws, for instance, with Hindu families. The housing schemes as well, they're targeted at women, and that's great, but it doesn't address the power dynamics in society. You know, so yes, women might be the owners of houses, but they're under pressure in a still a very deeply patriarchal society, and they lack the income to have power in their families. So there are some good things, and this is a little bit of progress, but it's not going to address the deeply patriarchal structure of Indian society, which Hindu nationalism is a part of.
Look, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but before I let you all go, I mean, Nisha, I want to start with you because you've seen so much in your huge career and seen how much things have changed for women in India. What do you think the future is for women in this country?
What is the future? As I say, I'm an incorrigible optimist, and I have seen rapid changes involving women. And I think the best thing that's happening in India today is the aspiration that young women have, that I can do it, that nothing is beyond my reach. And I think even the communities that are deprived and marginalized, I'll tell you, you don't have time, but I'll tell you one small story of a young Dalit girl I found in Muzaffarnagar district. She'd been pulled out of school. There was a drunkard father and so on. And I asked her, what do you want to become? She took all of 10 minutes to tell me one word. And that word was computer. You know, computer. Mm. Computer studies is what this girl, 10-year-old, who comes from a Dalit family, right at the bottom of the caste heap, without the wherewithal, but that was her dream. So I feel that, you know, today women are dreaming dreams, and you cannot stop that march. No government can stop that march.
Yeah. Maria, what do you think? Because obviously South Asian women, their voices are just building in Australia. The diaspora is just getting bigger and bigger every day. Where are things going for us as South Asian women in Australia?
I think whether we're talking about, you know, South Asian women still in South Asia or South Asian women in Australia, I think the way that we're going is we are going towards a future where we are taking up our rightful space in leadership. And I think that, you know, whether we're talking about the subcontinent or here, because, you know, we're looking at different sociopolitical contexts, different cultural contexts, I do think that this is going to apply differently. But we are seeing policy change. We are seeing cultural change. And for me, what that makes me really hopeful for is we are going to see a future where South Asian women, no matter where in the world we are going to exercise our right to vote, to have faith, to advocate, to choose what we do with our bodies, but, you know, ultimately to lead. And that makes me really hopeful and really excited.
It's been so brilliant to talk to all of you, especially, you know, as a journalist working here. Sometimes you just focus on the negatives, but it's so nice hearing the optimism that can come out of all of this as well, even though there are still so many steps forward that South Asian women need to take. I mean, thank you so much, Priya Chalko, Associate Professor of International Politics. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nisha Chaudhary, journalist, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Maria Thetil, author and former Miss Universe Australia, thank you as well.
What a privilege, you know, this space and this time with all of you. Thank you.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report on RN and ABC Listen. You can also check out my new podcast, Looking for Modi, on the ABC Listen app, where I look at the fascinating life of Narendra Modi and how he's changed India. The first episode is out on March 12. My name is Avani Dias. Thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.